All right. Well, welcome to the 2016 History Conference, and welcome to each one of you, however you came to hear, maybe from a poster that I put all over the place recently. So thanks a lot for coming, and I hope you're ready to learn. Okay, so we're gonna do two talks, one on the life of Martin Luther, and we'll have a short break for refreshments, and then one that is going to be more of a theological talk. And both of them are featuring the Heidelberg Disputation, which is a event that he took part in his life. Martin Luther lived such an interesting and exciting life that if you were to choose the top 10 most exciting events in his life, you probably would not choose the Heidelberg Disputation. In fact, his life story is often told where that is omitted, just because there's so much. But if you were taking the top 10 things that he did of theological importance, I think the Heidelberg Disputation would make the list. In fact, it might even be number one on the list. So both are going to have an emphasis on that. So for this talk, we're just going to tell Martin Luther's story. I was going to say from birth till death, but I'm not going to get all the way to the death. I'm going to have to cut it off. And I'll put special emphasis on the Heidelberg Disputation. And then the second hour, 45 minutes, will be the Heidelberg Disputation itself, the content of it, which is what is in this book. And I hope each of you have a book similar to this one in front of you, and bring it to the next one because we'll go through. Okay. October 31st, 1517, and we'll do some dates and stuff. This is the most important date to remember. If you remember one date, just remember this one. This is the date that Martin Luther posted the 95 Theses on the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg, which is considered the birthday of the Reformation and was even during his lifetime. So today is the 499th anniversary of the Reformation. And we're heading up to a very significant anniversary next year. And so you have a year to figure out what you want to do to celebrate the 500th, once-in-a-lifetime event, the 500th anniversary. I like to introduce Luther this way to give a sense of his importance in history. In all history, no person is written about more than Martin Luther, except one, and that's the Lord Jesus Christ. And then also to give a sense of how much he wrote, these are my books, and that's kind of a prized possession of mine, is the set of Martin Luther. If you took all of Luther's writings that survive, subtract the Bible, the German Bible, which he translated, this would represent one-third of what's left, which has been translated into English. Luther was constantly writing. He could write with his hand faster than printers could set type, and so he kept multiple printing presses constantly busy. On November 10th, 1483, Martin Luther was born. He was baptized the following day, November 11th, which is St. Martin's Day, an important saint, and so he was named Martin. His father, Hans, was a fairly prosperous in the mining business and had enough money to give his gifted son Martin the best education he could, which meant Latin. So don't imagine Martin Luther in school and now it's science class and then social studies or even German. Being educated meant doing Latin, and so that is what he studied. Martin Luther was outgoing and friendly even as a boy, but there was another side to him, and it's important for this story. He had a sensitive conscience. He doubted his own salvation, and he desired to have assurance of salvation. So he was a friendly person, but there was an anxious side of him. When Martin Luther was a young man, maybe 18, 19, his father sent him to law school to be a prosperous lawyer, and he did not like it. He did not like law school. During the first semester of law school, he was returning to school from a break where he had been visiting his family, and he was caught in the open in a thunderstorm. And so there's nowhere to go. There's lightning striking all around him. And there's something that someone like him feared more than death. at this time, and that is sudden death. Sudden death. And to tell you why, I have to tell you about the distinction that was made between two kinds of sins, venial and mortal sins. A mortal sin would destroy grace in you. So if you're saved and you commit a mortal sin, you're no longer saved. You're no longer headed for heaven. You've lost your salvation. You are headed for hell. That's a mortal sin. A venial sin, not quite as severe, would damage the grace that is within you, but not destroy it. So it's venial. It is not mortal. And for venial sins, you'd have to suffer in purgatory, where you would not atone for your sin in purgatory. In fact, everyone that makes it to purgatory is already forgiven for all their sins from the moment that they get into purgatory. But you suffer there to restore your soul, what's been damaged by all of your venial sins. So that's the solution for venial sins, purgatory. The solution for a mortal sin is the sacrament of penance, which is not the Mass. It is confession to a priest. And so you'd make confession. He'd give you absolution. If you've lost grace, if you've lost your salvation, you get it back through the sacrament of penance. Now, you might ask, what's a mortal sin? How bad does it have to be a mortal sin? Well, the definition for a venial sin is a desire unaccompanied by deliberate assent and not remaining long in the heart. That's a venial sin. So if it goes beyond that, accompanied by assent, remaining for a long time in the heart, it is a mortal sin. You can commit a mortal sin in your mind. You can commit a mortal sin and not know it, that you've done it. And so the Roman Catholic Church to this day encourages you to always assume you've committed a mortal sin out of humility, so that you'll avail yourself often of the sacrament of penance. But the problem with that is you have to have a priest to do the sacrament of penance. You can't do it without a priest. So if you die in your sickbed, there's a priest right there who can, if you've committed a mortal sin, you can do the sacrament of absolution, the sacrament of penance, and he'll absolve you. But if you die out in the field, there's no priest. There's no sacrament of penance. There's no hope for you if you've committed a mortal sin. So here's Martin Luther. He's out in the field. He's in great danger. Have I committed a mortal sin since the last time I did the sacrament of penance, confessed to a priest? I don't know. So if he has, he's not going to purgatory when he dies, but he's going to hell. And so in the thunderstorm, Luther encounters God coming in wrath, not just to take his life, not just to send him to purgatory, but to send him to hell forever. That's what he encounters in the thunderstorm. And so he cries out, "Saint Anne, help me. I'll become a monk." And he makes a vow in that way. He got back to school and he did just that. He joined the monks, the Augustinian monks. It terribly disappointed his father, but he was hoping that he would find the peace that he was looking for and rest for his soul by becoming a monk. So he took a vow, eventually, of becoming a monk. And a monk's vow involved three things always, and they were lifelong. It was a lifelong vow: poverty, celibacy, and obedience. Poverty, celibacy, and obedience. That's a monk's vow. And imagine how Hans took those things. Poverty, there's going to be nothing to provide for him in his old age. Celibacy, no grandchildren through Luther. And obedience, they really can't even be friends, because now Luther has a new family. He has new brothers. He has a new father. He's like a slave to his superior in the monastery. So Hans is totally opposed. But guess who Saint Anne is? She's the patron saint of minors. So he's sort of over a barrel. He wants to stay on the right side of Saint Anne. Luther threw himself into a monk's life, but found no peace. So his first time for his first Mass approached. It was a big event. His father came. He's not happy with the course his life had taken, but he's proud of him anyway. So he showed up, made a big gift to the monastery, made a banquet for the monks, and the moment came for Luther to do the thing that priests do. He was also a priest, which is to turn the bread and the cup into the body and blood of God by saying what he was authorized to say. And at that moment, he experienced terror. He's back in the field in the thunderstorm, experiencing the wrath of God. And so his hands are trembling. He gets through the service that he's supposed to get through. And then his father says a couple of things to him afterwards. He says, you're a monk. You know the commandment. It says, honor your father and mother. Why don't you do that? Why haven't you done that? And the second thing he says, how do you know that that thunderstorm that caused you to become a monk wasn't an apparition of the devil? And those things hit Luther, and they cut him to the heart. Luther, when he was a monk, he would confess to the priest that was assigned to him for 5 or 6 hours at a time. And so he would wear them out, confessing sins of the mind. And then he would receive absolution. As walking out the door, he'd remember more sins, and he'd sit down again and he'd confess for another half hour. And so he was driving them crazy, and his sins started to settle on what one arch sin that stood behind them all. And what was that? It was that he hated God, and he realized that he did not love God. That's the first commandment. But instead, he hated God. About this time, he took the longest trip of his life to Rome on foot over the Alps with another monk. And long story short, he found the holy city to be very unholy, and he was disappointed when he was there. I do want to say a little bit about what he was doing there. A man named Staupitz was the head of the order, and he decided that he was going to join the lax monasteries with the strict monasteries to be a good influence on the lax monasteries, so they'd start sort of keeping their rules as they should. But a lot of the monks were afraid that a bad apple would destroy the whole barrel, and so they protested over his head. And they chose Luther and another man as their emissary to go to Rome and represent them to Rome and try to appeal and get out of this. It was a little mini rebellion that happened. It was an utter failure. Luther and his friends spent 2 months in Rome and never received a hearing because it had already been decided. And so they had no chance of changing things. And this is how much of a rebel Luther was. He came back and he switched sides because he had taken a vow of obedience and he had gone through all the channels. And no, the answer was no. And so he switched sides. He was on Staupitz's side in this, and Staupitz became sort of a mentor to him. Staupitz was a wise man, and he was also a heavyweight theologian, and some of his theology anticipated some of the directions of the Reformation. Luther says that he literally saved his life because he was killing himself. By all the things he was doing to himself to punish himself. And Staupitz would tell him, your peace is not, it's found in the wounds of Christ. That's where you need to go to find peace. He also saw Luther's gifts, and he decided that Luther needed to be involved in Bible study and teaching. Staupitz himself was professor at the University of Wittenberg of biblical studies. But he had way too much administrative work as well, heading all these monasteries. So he had this idea. He said, Luther's going to replace me, and then it'll free me up, and he'll be doing what he needs to do. And so he ordered him to get his doctorate and become a professor so that he could replace him. And so Luther's thinking, how can I do that? I'm a tormented soul myself. How can I teach the Bible to other people? But he was commanded to do that, and so he obeyed. In 1512, at the age of about 29, Luther became professor of biblical studies at University of Wittenberg. They also had a shortage of preaching in the town, and so one of his duties was to preach at the church. And in that position, he would hold that for the rest of his life. And in that capacity, he would guide the Reformation until the day of his death. Around this time, after teaching a few years there, He had what's called sometimes the tower experience, because he said it happened to him in the tower of the monastery when he was studying the Bible. It's sometimes called the Reformation breakthrough or the Reformation discovery. And what was that? Well, let me put it in his words, him as an old man reflecting back on this. He says, though I lived as a monk without reproach, I felt that I was a sinner before God with an extremely disturbed conscience. I could not believe that he was placated by my satisfaction. I did not love, yes, I hated the righteous God who punishes sinners and secretly, if not blasphemy, certainly murmuring greatly. I was angry with God, and I said, as if indeed it is not enough that miserable sinners entering lost through original sin are crushed by every kind of calamity by the law of the Decalogue, without having God add pain to pain by the gospel, and also by the gospel threatening us with his righteousness and wrath. Thus I raged with a fierce and troubled conscience. Nevertheless, I beat importunately upon Paul at that place where it says, in it the righteousness of God is revealed in the gospel. Romans 1:18. I beat importunately upon Paul at that place, most ardently desiring to know what St. Paul wanted. At last, by the mercy of God, meditating day and night, I gave heed to the context of the words, namely, in it the righteousness of God is revealed, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. There I began to understand that the righteousness of God is that by which the righteous lives, by a gift of God, namely by faith. And this is the meaning. The righteousness of God is revealed by the gospel, namely the passive righteousness with which the merciful God justifies us by faith. As it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. Here I felt that I was altogether born again, and had entered paradise itself through open gates. And there a totally other face of the entire scripture showed itself to me. Thereupon I ran through the scriptures from memory. I also found in other terms an analogy as the work of God, that is the work that God does in us, the power of God, that is with which he makes us strong, the wisdom of God, with which he makes us wise, the strength of God, the salvation of God, the glory of God. And so he understood the righteousness of God is what God gives to us. It's a righteousness that comes from God. And this made all of the difference. He finally found peace that he was looking for and felt he had entered through heaven's gates. It's interesting. He chooses to write about his past life in very emotional terms there, not in a detached way. I hated the righteous God. I was angry with God. He says, thus I raged with a fierce and troubled conscience. Nevertheless, I beat importunately on Paul in that place. And so he portrays himself as angry with God until he found the gospel, found the good news, which caused him actually to love God with a love that came from God. I didn't read this part. And I extolled my sweetest word with a love as great as the hatred with which I had before I hated the word righteousness of God. Thus, that place in Paul, for me, truly was the gate of paradise. So Luther found, finally, peace. The peace that he was looking for, and peace with God. So he kept teaching with this new insight into Scripture. He talks about how the whole Scripture opened up to him in a different way because of this one discovery. He had a new insight. He had a new joy. And he began discovering that his insight was completely opposed to the theology of his day, which is the scholastic theology. You'll hear more about that. The schoolmen, basically the medieval Roman Catholic theologians of his day. And so he started convincing the rest of the faculty at the University of Wittenberg of his view, and eventually he succeeded. They were kind of won over one by one to his view. He knew he had something important to say, something that overturned scholastic theology and a totally a new to his day understanding of the scriptures. But at this point, he's a nobody. The University of Wittenberg is not an important school at all. It's not a prestigious school, and he's just a young professor at this school. One thing that they did in that day at schools is these theses, which we'll talk a little bit about. In fact, we're going to mention three sets of these theses tonight. And it was a part of higher education, kind of the apex of it, is the idea that you would be able to defend theses, whether you agreed with them or not. And they'd sort of build on each other in that way. And so you're supposed to be able to defend them in public and have other people dispute with you over these. And actually, we have something like that today, don't we? When you want to get a doctorate or a master's degree, you have to write a thesis. You have to, it has a thesis statement. It's something that's contestable, and then you have to support it. You have to argue for it. You have to defend your thesis. And Luther really liked these. In fact, I read that he introduced this, defending thesis at the University of Wittenberg. So September 1517, that's 1 month before our big birthday of the Reformation, so it's right on the cusp of that, he drew up 97 theses in September. This is not the 95 theses that come later. And I just want to tell you the title of it. It's called, and remember this, Disputation Against Scholastic Theology. Okay, and that's what he's trying to do, is against scholastic theology. And that is going to turn out to be a rough draft for the Heidelberg Disputation that we'll look at in the second talk. Now let me say a little bit about scholastic theology and what he meant by that. Way back in the time of Augustine, which was 1,000 years earlier from Luther, there was a false teacher named Pelagius who really did teach salvation by works. His idea of grace is that God told us the law. And wasn't that gracious of him? Because otherwise, how would we know how to please him? And so that's grace. God tells you what to do. And so Augustine argued against him and won the day, basically. Pelagius is considered a heretic. Because of that, the Roman Catholic Church has never taught, nor now teaches, salvation by works. The Roman Catholic Church has always been, and is now, anti-Pelagian, and has always insisted no one can please God apart from real grace, not just telling what the law is, but no one can please God apart from God helping every step of the way. And so that's against Pelagius. That's anti-Pelagian. Well, who does God help with his grace every step of the way? And the schoolmen, the scholastics, had an answer for that. And it's this important phrase, so that I put it in Latin. This is the only Latin I'm going to do, I think, for the whole thing. So I won't read it, but to the one doing what lies within him, God does not deny grace. And this was axiomatic for the scholastics. They didn't need to argue for this. They just assumed it. And actually, you still hear this. Talk about, you know, people say, well, at least I'm doing my best. That's what this means. Doing what lies within you. At least I'm doing, I'm not perfect, I know I'm not perfect, but I'm trying, at least I'm doing my best. I'm sure God will accept that. And so this became even abbreviated a lot of times to just quod in se est, and that was a really important thing that just showed up again and again. It was useful in a lot of ways. To the one who does his best, to the one who does what's in him, God will not deny grace. That's who he helps every step in the way, is the person who does his best, does what's within him. So what is the quod in se est, you might ask, the scholastics? Well, it's hard to say because it varies from person to person. Maybe your best is a little different from my best. The thing that lies within you is different from the thing that lies within me. Faith, that would be okay to be the quod in, the thing that lies within you to do, that God will honor with his grace. Humility, that could be one. It was used all over the place, and I'll give you an example of that. It was used in the sacrament of penance. Remember, that's the thing that you do to get your, if you've committed a mortal sin, you can get your salvation back through the sacrament of penance. And one ingredient in that process, because it was a whole process, one ingredient in that process was contrition. You had to actually be sorry for what you had done in the sacrament of penance. That was a part of it. And that was a part that was most difficult for Luther when he was confessing his sins, because he was never really sure that he was sorry or sorry enough for his sins. It wasn't sure if he could be more sorry for his sins. So they said, well, look, if you can't be sorry for your sin, could you at least be afraid of punishment? And if that's all you can manage, God can work with that. If that's the best that you can do, if that's the quod in se est, the thing that lies within you. God will start embellishing that, and he'll start building it up to perfection. It might take a million years in purgatory for him to make you perfect, but if you do what's in you, even if it's just something as small as just, I'm not really sorry, but I'm afraid of being punished, that's okay. God will show grace to the one who does the thing that lies within him. And that was supposed to help somebody like Luther, who had a troubled conscience. Well, look, just do your best. You know, don't worry about it. Just do the best that you can do, and God will honor that. For Luther, that was like a noose around his neck, and it terrified him. How can I know when I've done everything that lies within me, everything that I can possibly do? And so the 97 Theses Against Scholastic Theology strike out against that. And that what I mentioned there is something that's pretty near the foundation of that. Well, we're just 1 month before the 95 Theses. And at this time, the Pope needs money for a building project, which is going to reinvigorate Christendom, which has had a lot of problems in the past centuries at their time, by building a most magnificent edifice in Rome, St. Peter's Basilica, which now stands in Rome. And so the Pope, he needed money. He worked out this elaborate, ingenious, grand bargain that involved a lot of money. A number of parties, not just two, were involved, but a German prince was involved in a neighboring territory to Luther, who would allow indulgences to be sold in his territory, and the proceeds would go to the Pope. But these indulgences were it was a way to get time off in purgatory, for viewing a relic or for doing something else or for being granted to the Pope. But this is a plenary indulgence. If you get this indulgence and you go through the sacrament of penance to sort of activate it, you get all the time off. You're back at zero. However many years you have in purgatory is going to go to zero. It's a plenary indulgence that the Pope is giving through this. And the Pope had just the preacher to make the entire scheme work. And that was a man named John Tetzel. There he is with indulgences. He's got, that's what they look like, with the seals hanging off of it, and he's got a box there, a money box. John Tetzel, the preacher that would make this work. And the indulgences, they had a graduated scale. You paid, it was adjusted relative to your wealth, and that kind of fits the principle of you do what's within you. If you don't have anything, then it's free. If you're wealthy, then it's going to cost you quite a bit more. That's kind of the same idea. Let me read you a little bit of John Tetzel's preaching. Listen to, by the way, you can buy an indulgence not just for yourself, but for your relatives who have died. It's the way the Pope increased his market share, is to extend it to people in purgatory. Listen to the voices of your dear dead relatives and friends beseeching you and saying, pity us, we are in dire torment from which you can redeem us for a pittance. Do you not wish to? Open your ears. Hear the father saying to his son, the mother to her daughter, we bore you, nourished you, brought you up, left you our fortunes. And you are so cruel and hard that now you are not willing for so little to set us free. Will you let us lie here in flames? Will you delay our promised glory? Remember that you are able to release them, for as soon as the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. Will you not, for a quarter of a florin, receive these letters of indulgence, through which you are able to lead a divine and immortal soul into the fatherland of paradise? Luther, people from the church where Luther preached, it was not sold in their territory, but they could make a quick trip across the river into this other territory and buy indulgences. And so Luther's hearing about this, and he's enraged at what he's hearing. And so he took his new evangelical insights and applied them to the narrow issue of indulgences by writing 95 theses for scholarly debate. The title of this set of theses, the 95 theses, the big famous one, the Disputation on the Power and Efficacy of Indulgences. That's what he was offering up for debate. And on October 31st, he nailed it to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg. How dramatic was that moment? Well, We had it in that recording that played the boom, boom, you know, and it's like the coffin nails that are going into the Pope. On one hand, not really very dramatic. The door was the bulletin board for the university, and so nothing could be more normal than the professor posting a set of theses for disputation, for debate on the door of the church. They were written in Latin, so the people couldn't read them because that's the language they debated in, is in Latin, so the people couldn't understand it. On the other hand, he did do it for maximum effect. November 1st was All Saints Day, and inside that church were a whole bunch of relics, which were displayed at various times of year, and you could get indulgences, maybe 100 years, not a plenary indulgences, but some indulgence, time off in purgatory for viewing them. But on All Saints Day, November 1st, all the relics were viewed and displayed, and so you could go and view them. You could get, I think, like hundreds of thousands of years off by viewing all the relics that were displayed on All Saints Day. And so it would happen on Halloween, what happened on October 31st is that it was kind of a festival around the church with people kind of milling around, waiting to get in for the next day. And some of them kind of camped out by the door. So like when the iPhone comes out, you know, people camped out by the Apple store. It's kind of like something like that idea. So there, it was for maximum effect when people were thinking about indulgences and also were there in public. Well, it was an overnight sensation. It was translated off the door and sent to the printers who sold it and distributed it. Luther said it was as if angels had carried the message. In 2 weeks, everyone in Germany had heard of the 95 Theses, and not much longer, he was a household name in all Europe. He was an overnight celebrity. He went from being a nobody to being a household name overnight, at 34 years old, and his life was more than half over at that point. What do they say? Well, they're really not really very thrilling when you read them. I won't have a history conference featuring the 95 Theses. Some of them were what you would expect, like number 50. The Christians are to be taught that if the Pope knew the exactions of the indulgence preachers, he would rather the Basilica of St. Peter were burned to ashes rather than built up with skin, flesh, and bones of his sheep. So that's kind of what you'd expect in his protest. Most of it, though, although it's worthwhile, it follows an argument that's hard to follow because it's all in the language of the sacrament of penance, of which indulgence was a part, and so it's a little bit hard to follow. It captured the imagination of the people, though. They knew I think they knew that the indulgence selling was wrong. And I think they liked it as much for what it said as also the way that he said it. Criticism of prominent persons in the church was usually done in a very deferential tone, a very submissive way. But this was like what I just read. You know, this was angry and bold and open and frank in what it said. And so the people were eating it up. These were difficult months for Luther. And here we, the months after this. And here we get into the part about the Heidelberg disputation. I don't know if we're going to get much further than that because I'm looking at the clock and I don't have a lot of time left. But this is where we get into the Heidelberg disputation part because it came right after this. Oh, let me do this. Okay. So the 95 Theses, the word of it, it soon reached the Pope's ears. His first response was to say, "Brother Martin is a fine intellect, and these things are monks' squabbles." That was his first response. I really like this explanation from this book, so I'll read you a description of this. It says, this is Pope Leo. "Leo's personal appearance has been perpetuated in Raphael's celebrated picture in the Pitti Gallery of Florence," which I think is this picture. "He was not a handsome man. His fat, shiny, effeminate countenance with weak eyes protrudes in this picture from a close-fitting cap. The unwieldy body is supported by thin legs. His movements were sluggish, and during ecclesiastical functions, his corpulence made him constantly wipe the perspiration from his face and hands to the distress of the bystanders. But when he laughed or spoke, the unpleasant impression vanished. He had an agreeable voice, knew how to express himself with elegance and vivacity, and his manner was easy and gracious. Let us enjoy the papacy since God has given it to us, he is said to have remarked after his election. So he was not easily roused, but he pretty soon became a pretty bad foe of Luther. The men around the Pope immediately grasped the situation and the seriousness of it. And so his second impression was, the thesis had been written by a drunken German who will change his mind after he becomes sober again. And things started moving after that. So he set, and the men around him, they set in motion kind of an amazing array of complicated processes that were set in motion to silence Luther. And so these efforts to silence Luther resulted in four showdowns that took place in about 4 years' time. And I don't even think we're going to get to maybe past the first one, which is the Heidelberg disputation. In all of these showdowns, these four showdowns, there's a protector behind the scenes for Martin Luther, and that was Frederick the Wise, the prince of the territory they lived in. Frederick, in a previous generation, his line had to divide their territory with his cousin's family. And when they did, they lost the school that was in that territory, the University of Leipzig. And so Frederick has no school in his territory, and so he said, well, I'll start one. And so he started the University of Wittenberg, and that school, it made a pretty modest start, but that was his baby. And Luther had put it on the map, that school. Everybody's talking about the University of Wittenberg, and so he was sort of behind the scenes, and he was also a very powerful prince in Germany, and so he was always sort of behind the scenes protecting Luther through all of these. The first showdown is the Heidelberg Disputation. And this one turned out to be a huge success for Luther and infinitely more pleasant than the remaining three. And so this is sort of a nice story to tell. So this happened the following spring. So it's October when he posts the thesis, and this happens the following spring. The first lever that the Pope pulled was the obvious one. He's a monk. He's taken a vow of obedience. And so they appealed to Staupitz. The Augustinians were having a triannual meeting of the monks in Heidelberg. It was already scheduled. They said, bring him to the meeting and make it part of your business that year to force him to recant at the meeting. In the meantime, they put a gag order on Luther. He wasn't allowed to talk about indulgences, the thing that he's written, which he obeyed because he was supposed to do that. And that was a difficult time for Luther. And so he wrote things like this to his friends about the 95 Theses. He says, far beyond my expectation, the theses have now been printed so often and arrived from place to place that I am sorry of this mess, not because I do not like to see the truth become known and spread among the people, for that was my sole object, but because this is not an apt way for educating the people, for there are in the theses some things that are doubtful even to me, and some things I should have stated quite differently and with greater assurance, or have omitted if I had expected this result. Wrote to another friend, I wish to publish a tract in German on the efficacy on indulgences in order to suppress those theses which are vague. So he's working on a book to defend, or a little pamphlet to defend the thesis, which he finished actually after the disputation. Here's another letter that he wrote during that time. Accordingly, when I had called all into the arena, and no one came, because that's what he did. The disputation, nobody took him up for the disputation. They put a gag order on him. And when at length I perceived that my theses were being spread further than I had wished and were everywhere accepted as assertions, not as points to be debated, I was forced against my expectation and purpose to bring my infant mind and ignorance among the people and to publish explanations and proofs for them. That's the book he's working on. Believing that I would do better to incur the dishonor of my inexperience than to allow those to be in error who might believe all those points to be assertions. There are among them points regarding which I am in doubt, Regarding some, I profess my ignorance, some I even deny. None, however, I assert stubbornly, while I submit all to the Holy Church and her judgment. So there was a summons for him to go to Heidelberg. He was apprehensive about it. He wrote this letter. Everybody advises me not to go to Heidelberg, lest perchance they will do by guile what they cannot accomplish by force. However, I shall fulfill my vow of obedience and go thither on foot. Staupitz wanted him to get a hearing at this meeting, wanted him to have a disputation, and perhaps to protect him, said, don't debate on indulgences. That's too narrow. Broaden your scope. Debate on the thing that you were working on before all this came, against the scholastic theology. Take a broader and probably a less controversial topic for your dispute. So Martin Luther went. He set out with another monk. That was the rules of the order. They always traveled in two. So with Leonard Beyer, and he's named in your little pamphlet because he helped Luther do the disputation. It was only 317 miles away. Wittenberg's in the north and Heidelberg's in the southwest of Germany. That's a pretty long ways to go. And Luther was determined to walk the whole way because he had taken a vow of poverty. And that's how poor people travel. They walk. It was a beautiful spring. There was still snow in the high passes, and there was flowers in the valley. And so Luther found the journey invigorating after all this stress that he's had. It cheered him up, and it put him in a good frame of mind. And so he wrote along the way, everything is all right, except that I confess that I sinned in coming on foot. Since my contrition is perfect and full penance has been imposed for it, I need no indulgence for remission. I am terribly fatigued, but there are no vehicles to be had anywhere, and thus my contrition, penitence, and satisfaction is abundant, great, thorough, and sufficient. So he's in a good mood and enjoying the time with his friend. There's some thought that the thesis were formulated along the way of the Heidelberg thesis in conversation. There were other friends who joined and talked. They eventually got a wagon. They arrived and met for disputation. There was other business that the people there, but they spent days disputing the thesis that Luther presented. So in your book, it says, page one, Brother Martin Luther, Master of Sacred Theology, will preside, and Brother Leonard Beer, Master of Arts and Philosophy, will defend the following thesis. So it was some sort of team effort. I haven't been able to figure out. I think Luther did most of the talking on it. And then it says on the second page, distrusting completely our own wisdom according to that counsel of the Holy Spirit, this is the preamble, we humbly present to the judgment of all those who wish to be here these theological paradoxes. That's what he's presenting here. So that it may become clear whether they have been deduced well or poorly from St. Paul, and especially his chosen instrument, and from St. Augustine, his most trustworthy interpreter. So they disputed. People argued with him that were there, but they mostly just listened, and he won them over. He won most of them over that were there. Let me read this. Oh, this is Luther's report about it after it's over. He says, my disputation, the reverend doctors gladly admitted and argued with me with such moderation that I am much obliged to them on that score. Although the theology seems strange to them, nevertheless, they skirmished with it shrewdly and politely, except one, who is the fifth and junior professor. He moved the whole audience to laughter by saying, if the peasants heard this, they would stone you to death. So we got a pretty good reception. There were six young future reformers present in the audience at the Heidelberg disputation. The most important of them was Martin Bucer. And this is what he wrote. I gotta find it. Well, I think I'll read it in the next one. How's that? I'll find it and I'll read it to you. Another account of this, the count to Frederick, he says, Luther has acquitted himself so well here with his disputation that he has won no small praise for for your Grace's University and was greatly lauded by many learned persons, and that's what the Prince Frederick wanted to hear about his school. Luther also, he was pleased by how he was received by the young, and he had a hope for the young generation. And so he says this, he says, with Dr. Usingen, who was my partner in the wagon, somebody who rode with him, I conferred more than with all the rest, trying to win him over. But whether I accomplished anything, I do not know. That is what comes of growing old in wrong opinions. But the minds of our lads and of youths in general are tremendously different from them, and I have a great hope that as Christ turned to the Gentiles when rejected by the Jews, so now his theology too, which those opinionated old men reject, will pass over to the younger generation. And so it was especially the young people that received his theology at the disputation. Luther returned. He said, Christ being kind to me, I've returned at last to my home and reached Wittenberg on Sunday, May 15th. I had started out on foot and returned by wagon. I was well all the way. The food agreed with me remarkably, so that some think I look stronger and fatter now. And he was actually, you think of Luther as fat, but he was actually as skinny as a rail at this point. He was like a walking corpse is how he was described. And so everything agreed with him here. The disputation went great. It deepened his conviction. It raised his courage. And when he published the defenses of the 95 Theses, it was clearer, it was stronger, and he didn't take back a single one of them, of the 95 theses. So it's actually a pretty nice story of the Heidelberg disputation. It didn't last long. Rome quickly upped the ante. He had a second showdown, this time with Cajetan, which was extremely stressful for him. He went with Leonard Beer, the same monk, his brother, and the one reason why he chose him to go is because when they went to this second showdown in Augsburg, they wanted to do the Heidelberg disputation over again. They wanted to present these same theses. Okay, well, I did not get through at all what I wanted to get through, but I did get through the part about the Heidelberg disputation. There's way more to go that I didn't get to. I think I'm just going to let you eat the refreshments, and then we'll do the next one. How's that? Okay. So take 15 minutes.